Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Reyes, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
Good afternoon and thank you for appearing by Zoom, which I think we're all getting a little tired of, but it's going to be proceeding for a while. This appellate proceeding has the same rules that we would normally have if we were live and in the courtroom, save and except you don't have to stand unless you feel more comfortable doing that. You'll each have 15 minutes for presentation of your case in chief. An additional 5 minutes will be reserved to appellant counsel if you choose to utilize that. I'm going to ask that you remain muted unless it's your turn to speak. I'm also going to ask that you please introduce yourself and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before you commence making your argument. I'll ask our marshal to now call the next case for consideration.
Calling case number A200735, State of Minnesota versus DeAndre O'Neill Jackman.
And Mr. Cascarano, when you are ready to proceed. Cascarano, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please this court, counsel, my name is Craig Cascarano. I represent the appellant DeAndre Jackman, who I filed a motion to withdraw his plea prior to his sentencing in the matter that's before the court. I don't think it's prudent nor necessary for me to get into the facts. There were two defendants here, Ms. Lewis and Mr. Jackman, that is relevant into one of the grounds upon which we moved to withdraw his plea of guilty. In any event, he, prior to his sentencing, we made a motion to withdraw his plea of guilty on three grounds. One, that his prior trial attorney indicated that unless he pled guilty, there would be a Blakely motion filed. Number two, that although there was no DNA on the gun, that the prosecutor would use that as inculpatory evidence. And number three is the issue as to whether or not after the co-defendant pled and sentenced, whether he then could withdraw his plea of guilty and call the co-defendant as a witness.
Well, you didn't have an evidentiary hearing on those issues, and that's part of what you're objecting to, but expand on why you feel that COVID restrictions impacted your ability in that regard.
Well, in my initial submission to the court, the COVID restrictions prevented me from going over and presenting to him a piece of an affidavit. I mean, under normal circumstances, if we weren't in this climate that we're in right now, I would go meet with him face-to-face in the Hennepin County Jail, have him sign an affidavit. I would have filed that along with my initial motion to withdraw the plea of guilty. That wasn't possible because number one, the jail was not allowing contact visiting. And number two, they certainly weren't allowing us to submit any paperwork. That issue, however, was resolved in my mind because the court at first, I made a motion for an evidentiary hearing. It was denied. And it was denied because the court wanted to have me submit an affidavit, or ultimately, the court order was that they were going to bring him into court and have him assign the affidavit in court. I, although it's not part of the record, I contacted the clerk of court and I indicated I would draft an affidavit, send it over to him via mail, and he would sign it and shoot it back to me. And that then was filed with the court, which the court used as his testimony.
Are you, you're then not presenting that as an issue for us as an appellate body?
Well, I am. I'm not, I'm indicating that the court wanted an affidavit. I submitted the affidavit. I'm not conceding the fact that the court should have still held an evidentiary hearing. And here's my thought on that.
So essentially, if I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but I am, you're saying that the problem was resolved by the trial court, but you still have that as an objection.
Yes.
The procedure. All right.
Correct. And I should, I don't want to get sidetracked, but maybe I should comment on the procedure. This was not a petition for post-conviction relief, obviously, because he hadn't been sentenced yet. I made reference in my brief to the procedure in which is followed and the law that governs the whether or not a court on a petition for post-conviction relief should have an evidentiary hearing. My position is that those rules should equally apply to at least as far as an evidentiary hearing with regard to a motion to withdraw a plea of guilty. Here's why I say that. If I could say just one thing, I don't mean to interrupt, but what's curious under these circumstances is the allegations that Mr. Jackman made are unrebutted, that there's been no testimony by his trial counsel. And under normal circumstances, hearings are held and the trial counsel would testify that, no, I didn't tell him about the Blakely, or no, I didn't say that the gun would be used against him, despite the fact that there was no DNA on the gun. We submitted his quote testimony via affidavit and it is unrebutted. So it's my position. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Finish your sentence.
No. I never say anything that doesn't add knowledge to silence. So I'm going to be quiet for a little while.
So I just have a simple question.
Yes.
When you asked for an evidentiary hearing, did you give any reason for wanting that evidentiary hearing to the district court besides the fact that you couldn't get in to see your client to have an affidavit?
I don't honestly remember what the initial motion was, Judge. I guess I just figured that it was important to have an evidentiary hearing to, quote, ferret out the truth. It was clearly my position that he would testify consistent with his affidavit, and then the state would present testimony saying that his allegations are not true. I find it curious that the trial court, decided not to have an evidentiary hearing without even hearing from the trial counsel. And then after we submitted the affidavit, that's when she denied the entire motion. There is no evidence in this record that rebuts Mr. Jackman's allegations.
So, Mr. Castellano?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think you quite to just speaking for myself. I mean, I think you obviously raise a valid concern about not being able to provide the affidavit with the papers that you normally would file, but you would agree that in a typical situation, that's what happens is you have a signed affidavit from your client and that's the process. There's no right to an evidentiary hearing in the normal process, correct?
Yes and no. I don't mean to be vague, Your Honor. I apologize for that, but if I would, for example, in another case, file a motion to withdraw the plea of guilty, I would in the motion indicate the reasons I would likely submit an affidavit, but I would also request the court to set a hearing for the defendant to testify with regard to that. Sometimes it's granted, sometimes it's not. So I can't, that I think is more a preference with the court, but I guess it's my opinion that based upon the case law, and certainly the allegations here that were unrebutted, that the court should have held an evidentiary hearing even after the affidavit was submitted to the court. Now, they didn't, and the court the trial court filed an extensive and very detailed memorandum denying the motion to withdraw the plea of guilty, not only dealing with the initial motion to withdraw, but also dealing with the overtones of ineffective assistance of counsel. All of those, of course, go to the issue as to whether or not he was given appropriate advice, and if he was not, whether or not those precipitated his plea of guilty. And he indicated in his affidavit that he would have not have pled guilty had he known that some of this stuff that was presumably imparted to him by trial counsel was not true.
Well, and you raised several issues there, and I'll see if I can work through them backwards. First of all, I think the district court, I totally agree with you. The district court certainly made a very detailed findings and memorandum. But as part of that, if I recall correctly, the district court said that there's no claim of ineffective assistance of counsel and made that point very clear. But second of all, I think you still seem to acknowledge that there's no right to have an evidentiary hearing. That's still discretionary with the district court as to whether or not to grant one. And I read your brief to argue that the district court should always grant one in a situation like this and basically create new law by adopting the standard under post-conviction proceeding.
If the court read my brief and I was inartful in suggesting that an evidentiary hearing is required in every case, that's certainly, number one, it's not the law. Number two, that wasn't my intention in the brief. And that's why I made reference to balancing that a court does in a petition for post-conviction relief and whether or not to have an evidentiary hearing. I do not now, nor would I ever, indicate to this court that a hearing is always required in a motion to withdraw the plea of guilty. I'm not suggesting that. What I am suggesting, however, in this particular circumstance, given the allegations, even though ineffective assistance of counsel was not explicit, certainly it was implicit in the allegations, and that it's my position that the balancing of essentially the same kind of balancing test that would be done in a petition for post-conviction relief as to whether or not it's necessary should be the same as a motion to withdraw the plea of guilty. The trial court said, it looked at the allegations, looked in the affidavit and said that a hearing was not necessary. She's not required to have a hearing, so don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But nevertheless, I disagree with the court and that a hearing should be held. These allegations, without getting into them in detail, are significant. And the affidavit...
Let's get into the allegations because you only have 4 minutes left and we need to talk about the reasons advanced in support of your motion because a decision was made on those. So I don't care where you start. If you want to start with the fingerprint on the gun, that's fine. Or if you want to leap to a different one, that's fine too.
I'll do this very quickly because I tried to artfully put them in my or outline them in my brief as best I can. It is inconceivable to me that any defense attorney can indicate that if DNA is not found in a gun, that the county attorney's office would introduce the gun as evidence against the defendant. Now, the trial court went through a detailed but kind of contorted argument as to why they would introduce the gun. I think the operative issue on that, Judge, is that it would be introduced as evidence inculpatory of Mr. Jackman committing the crime. That's ludicrous. Every case that this court sees on review and I see as a trial lawyer, the DNA is on the gun and introduced against the defendant. It's hard to say that you don't have a gun if your DNA is on the gun. But to now say, well, DNA is not on the gun, they're still going to use it against you. That doesn't prevent the county attorney's office from submitting the gun as evidence, but no county attorney is going to put a gun into evidence where the DNA is not on the gun. That would be basically what the defense would do. Secondly, on the Blakely issue, I raised my eyebrow, I guess is the best way I can put it, when the court indicated that the Blakely issue could be filed at any time. I don't disagree with that, but there is no chance, and I want to emphasize, there is no chance that a court or a jury is going to find aggravating circumstances in this particular case, when the underlying offense, the drug case, calls for probation. The only reason that Mr. Jackman ended up in jail is because of the 60911 charge having a gun in the commission of a drug offense. There are no aggravating circumstances in this case, none, period. So to indicate to Mr. Jackman that if he goes to trial, they're going to file a Blakely motion, that is ludicrous. There isn't a criminal defense attorney in this bar who's worth his salt who would ever tell a client that. And I, although I may be more animated than I should be, you can tell that I feel very strongly about that. The third issue, of course, is this being able to call a co-defendant at trial as an exculpatory witness. I will candidly admit that I wasn't as artful as I should be in bringing this to the court's attention, nor in my brief. I think the whole concept of it was that Mr. Jackman would be able to withdraw his plea after the co-defendant was sentenced. That's really not the case. What he could do, however, is call the co-defendant as a exculpatory witness. Now, I'm not unmindful of the fact that Mr. Jackman came when Ms. Lewis entered a plea of guilty and exonerated her from the gun. I'm not unmindful of that. But nevertheless, I don't think that takes away from the trial counsel indicating that he could somehow manipulate, and I believe that's the case, manipulate the criminal justice system to move to withdraw the plea of guilty. I don't think Mr. Jackman is at fault for that. You know, I don't think he has the sophistication to figure it out. The whole idea is that if the co-defendant is, I think the co-defendant was sentenced, and then Mr. Jackman would then be able to withdraw his plea as long as he was not sentenced before the co-defendant was sentenced. That was the idea, I think. But again, that I agree with the county attorney when they said it was a manipulation of the criminal justice system. It was, and it was perpetuated by his trial counsel, and I believe that precipitated his plea of guilty. I say I have left, so I have another. If the court doesn't have any questions, I appreciate your time.
You'll have your rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Cascarano. I'm trying that again. We'll turn to respondent counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. This court should affirm appellant's conviction because the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying appellant's motion to withdraw his plea. Appellant did not establish any reasons why it would be fair and just to allow him to withdraw his plea or why manifest injustice would require withdrawal. Further, this court should affirm the district court's discretionary denial of an evidentiary hearing.
Ms. Folks,
yes.
Do we even need to get into the manifest just injustice? I mean, it looks like, I mean, I realize that this court did analyze it under both standards, but it looks like appellant, and I can certainly clarify this with the appellant's counsel as well, it looks like the claim was only brought under the fair and just standard, which is permissible in this situation before sentencing.
Correct. That's obviously the standard based on the posture of the case. And I think the district court was probably
And that's a lower standard too.
It is. Yes, it's a lower standard. And I think the district court analyzed that just as a matter of being thorough of all the possible reasons the plea could be withdrawn in terms of not being accurate, not being intelligent. Additionally, obviously, if there was a finding of ineffective assistance of counsel as a matter of law, that is a manifest injustice and therefore obviously also meets the lower standard. But I guess it would depend on how this court handled the claim, but certainly the lower standard is what applies here based on the procedural posture. And I'm happy to answer any other questions that the panel has at this time.
I have another question. So going to the allegations in the affidavit, why isn't that sufficient? Why shouldn't the district court have held a hearing, particularly as you note in your own brief, that the last one in particular would seem to be a way to try to abuse the legal system, take advantage of the legal system. Wouldn't it make sense to have a hearing on that to really find out what's going on here? Is that really what trial counsel said to him? Or is this just a misunderstanding? Did appellant just misunderstand what trial counsel said? But taken on its face, those seem to be pretty serious comments with significant ramifications to make.
I think that it is firmly within the trial court's discretion. And I think in this instance that part of it, the district court found wasn't true on its face because the defendant couldn't have been entering a plea before the co-defendant entered her plea of guilt as part of how it was framed, that his attorney told him to plead guilty first was part of the allegation in the affidavit. And the district court noted that piece, for instance, could not be true because as the record is clear, the co-defendant entered her guilty plea first. I think otherwise that the district court basically on all of the allegations said that even if they were true, they weren't rising to the level of the first prong of Strickland. That's sort of my interpretation of her order. And so if they're not falling below objective reasonableness, the counsel's performance, then the Strickland standard isn't going to be met. And so she decided that they didn't need an evidentiary hearing. So that's my interpretation of her order, is that she sort of said, well, even if this is true, if the trial counsel didn't give good advice about how to handle his case in relation to the co-defendant, about whether or not she could be called as an exculpatory witness, that none of those things would fall below sort of objective reasonableness. They'd fall more in the trial strategy.
I want to push back a little bit on the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, because I think the district court also made it clear that that claim had not been raised, and really seemed to focus, the way I read the district court order, was focusing also on the fact that a lot of these are more trial strategy, which we don't second, we as courts don't second guess that.
Correct. I think that, the district court's order is clear. She states very clearly that ineffective assistance of counsel was not raised. And in reviewing the filings below, the affidavit, the memo, the motion, the phrase ineffective assistance of counsel is not there. Strickland is not cited, nor any of those cases. So it's clear that that was not raised as a distinct claim. And I think the district court was trying to cover all the bases, because there were, as she describes in her order, vague complaints about counsel's performance. And so I think if it's not a matter of ineffective assistance of counsel, she's already assessed that, well, it certainly isn't meeting the fair and just standard, what's been complained of. And so the only way he would be entitled to relief was if these types of complaints about counsel did rise to the level of ineffective assistance of counsel. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what I think the order reflects.
Okay, thank you. What about the district court's statements about these really all go to trial strategy?
I agree, and I think that's how I briefed this as well, which is that the three pieces that were complained about, the issue of the DNA and the gun, as well as possible Blakely, and how the co-defendant could or could not be an exculpatory witness. I think that the district court's assessment that these are all in that realm of trial strategy, I agree with that. And I think as far as like the first one on the DNA, in this case, the state clearly would be introducing the firearm since they charged it with the firearm enhancement. And it's my understanding from looking at the record below that there was a mixture of DNA found on the gun. It's not that no DNA was found, but it's that that mixture did not could not be interpreted by the crime lab. So it didn't meet their criteria for interpretation. And so you'd expect that the state would bring in a DNA analyst, a forensic scientist, who would explain why that is the case. How you're going to describe that to your client about whether or not that's inculpatory or not, I mean, that's kind of... I'm assuming every trial attorney would have a different way they'd describe the impact of that evidence, but I would certainly say that then that falls under trial strategy.
I want to go back and talk a little bit about his trial attorney saying or telling him, and of course the defendant's going to hear it as a threat, that there would be an upward departure sought, despite the fact no Blakely was on the table. That bothers me. And I know it's in the eyes of the defendant as to whether he or she was badgered and how compelling trial counsel was as far as insisting that that could happen. Isn't that something that the trial court should have heard to make a credibility determination as to whether or not there was a falling out between the defendant and trial counsel?
I think my position is that as the issue was raised with the affidavits and the filings from state and defense counsel, that the district court didn't abuse her discretion finding that he wasn't entitled to relief. I will say, though, that if perhaps the issue was framed differently and that it had more of a flavor of coercion, then you can see how the district court really should have held an evidentiary hearing. I think State versus Kaiser, I think that might be one of those cases where the defendant really said he was coerced by his attorney. And so then that's going to suggest that you need to have some testimony from both the defendant as well as the counsel.
So, Ms. Folks, was there anything in the record that reflects a request for an evidentiary hearing after the affidavit?
No.
The signed affidavit was in place?
No, my review of the record shows that the initial filing when an affidavit wasn't possible for perfectly understandable reasonings with the complexities of COVID was that the motion itself specifically says that the request for the evidentiary hearing was for the purposes of having the defendant testify to the things that were listed in that motion because an affidavit wasn't possible.
Okay. Was there any other reason other than the fact that an affidavit was not possible given? It's the same question I ask appellate counsel.
Not in the filings. I do not believe so.
Thank you.
So if that's the case, is that issue forfeited then?
I don't know the answer to that question. From my reading and looking at sort of the sequence of how this evolved, I don't think that any point after the district court's ordering appellant to produce an affidavit that the request for an evidentiary hearing was renewed. So I'm not sure what the answer to that is.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that issue is not forfeited. Why shouldn't the standard for post-conviction relief apply in this situation? Because it does apply for a claim of manifest injustice, right? But not necessarily for fair and just. Why shouldn't it be the same across the board?
Right. As Your Honor stated, it is the standard that's applied for post convictions, which manifest injustice as something after sentencing falls within that procedure. You know, the cases that I found that talked about the standard, I think it was Shorter was the one case, basically said that the district court, if facts have been alleged that indicate the need for a hearing, then one should be held. And I think that makes it fairly discretionary. I would say in this case, I think even looking at the post-conviction standard, which is that I think that it would still, unless the petition conclusively shows that they're not entitled to relief, then they should have a hearing. You know, here, I think that's sort of the approach the district court took. The district court appeared to say, well, even if that's what you were told, this is not rising to the level of fair and just. This is not rising to the level of the first prong of Strickland. I don't think you get a different result applying that standard here.
Anything else?
I will just say in conclusion then that guilty pleas facilitate the efficient administration of justice, and case law is clear that more than a change of heart is needed to withdraw a guilty plea. And here the appellant made a voluntary, intelligent, and knowing plea under oath. He emphatically and thoroughly stated his guilt under oath, not once but twice. And to reverse the district court in this matter would be to undermine the integrity of the plea negotiations. She was biting me. The state respectively requests this court hold the district court did not abuse its discretion and affirm appellant's conviction.
Oh, just for the record, in case somebody thinks that Judge Jessen or I were biting you, we're talking about look like a pet in the background. That happens. All right, Mr. Cascarano, we're back to you for the last word. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'll be very quick. I need to address what Judge Reyes indicated. The record's very clear. We filed a motion to withdraw the plea of guilty. Let me sit up here a little. Requested an evidentiary hearing. The court, in its initial order, denied the evidentiary hearing, but reserved the motion to withdraw the plea. So we did ask for an evidentiary hearing. What we didn't do is ask the court to reconsider her original denial. Rather, what we did is follow the court's order in getting an affidavit. The court wanted to bring Mr. Jackman into court. That seemed to be very difficult given the COVID situation in the jail. And it was much easier in my mind for me to simply send an affidavit to him in the jail via mail with instructions to get it back to me and sign it, which he did. So we made a motion for an evidentiary hearing, and in that motion, which was the initial motion to withdraw the plea of guilty, that contained all the allegations that Mr. Jackman corroborated, so to speak, in his affidavit. So I very strongly waive any issue with regard to having an evidentiary hearing. What I keep on falling back upon let me mention this thing about trial strategy. I consider myself, I started in the public defender's office in 1975. When I was there, I would look at older lawyers and I go, boy, those guys are dinosaurs. Guess what? I guess I'm now a dinosaur because I've been around for about 44 years. And I think I know what I'm talking about when I say trial strategy. They're telling a client that they're, unless you plead guilty, they're going to file a Blakely motion. Has nothing to do with trial strategy. It has everything to do with telling your client, you better plead guilty or you're going to get really hurt down the road.
But you didn't allege in his affidavit, he didn't allege, as Ms. Volks pointed out and reminded me, there's no allegation that he was coerced. He's saying that he was told. So we don't know what level that was.
Exactly why we have to have an evidentiary hearing. But in his affidavit, the last statement is he would have never pled guilty had he known what he knows now, which is there's no chance a Blakely motion is going to succeed in a case like this when the underlying offense is a probationary offense. He got more than what he would have otherwise received if he just straight pled to a controlled substance crime in the third degree. He got 36 months because of the gun. There's no Blakely involved in this case. For any lawyer to say that is absolutely ludicrous. Secondly, trial strategy has nothing to do with telling your client that unless you plead guilty, they're going to introduce the gun, despite the fact it doesn't have any DNA. I would relish the fact to have a county attorney introduce a gun that has mixed DNA that doesn't conclusively show my client's DNA. There's no doubt in this particular, I don't think they need to introduce the gun, by the way, in the case in chief, because it's a sentencing issue. It's not an issue for the gun or the jury. So the 6911 is a sentencing issue. But nevertheless, that has nothing to do with trial strategy. Trial strategy is whether or not, for example, the county attorney's office is going to introduce the gun or whether or not they're going to file a Blakely motion for his trial counsel to tell him that you better plead guilty or else, number one, they're going to file a Blakely motion. Number two, they're going to introduce the gun and that's absolutely going to be devastating to you, has nothing to do with trial strategy. And whether or not we use the word coercion, whether or not we use the word of ineffective assistance of counsel, the bottom line is he pled guilty based upon inappropriate advice. I fashioned this thing not by ineffective assistance of counsel. And I did that for a reason, because the issue is whether or not it's fair and just based upon his affidavit and what I think should have been testimony, whether it's fair and just for him to be allowed to withdraw his plea of guilty based upon the allegations contained in the affidavit. And those, I still contend very strongly, that those allegations in the affidavit are unrebutted. And if they are unrebutted, I just cannot see a situation where it's not fair and just to allow him to withdraw the plea of guilty.
Mr. Cusimano,
yes.
Judge Warkey, if I might ask one more question. So thank you. So Mr. Cusimano, one thing we really haven't talked about are the circumstances surrounding this. And I think there's something unique in this case in that appellant not only pleaded guilty, but testified at his co-defendant's hearing, and the district court judge specifically said, you know, be careful what you're doing here because I am hearing your case too, and I'm the one who's going to sentence you, and whatever you say here more or less could be used against you. And his own trial counsel warned him against making any statements at co-defendant's sentencing. And so he spoke and he took full responsibility for the crimes. So isn't that something that really has to be taken into account here, that's rather different, rather unique than other cases?
It's very unique. It's very unique, Your Honor. But I still don't believe that it detracts from the allegations contained in the motion to withdraw the plea. And herein lies the problem, if I may indulge the court. Herein lies the problem. you and I now are trying to guess as to what he was told with regard to this issue about calling a co-defendant. We know he testified at the co-defendant's case and exonerated her, and she received a dispositional departure. He claims that the lawyer, sometime in the case, indicated that he should plead guilty, and then after she was sentenced, that he could withdraw the plea, as opposed to saying, after she's sentenced, you can call her as an exculpatory witness. We don't know what the exact conversation was. Therein lies the problem with why we don't have an evidentiary hearing. We need to have an evidentiary hearing. And if I was the county attorney's office, with all due respect, I would have asked for a hearing to ferret out the truth as to what was said. That's why we need to have a hearing in these things. We can't just decide it based upon allegations contained in an affidavit, because there needs to be cross-examination. There needs to be testimony from the trial counsel. I never said that. Or if he did, he would say, this is what he said. Mr. Jackman misunderstood it. I never said anything about Blakely. Or if I did, this is what I said. And if that's there, and it's kind of smoothed out, so to speak, then I think the court can legitimately say there's no fair and just reason to withdraw the plea of guilty.
And Mr. Coscarano, I'm going to see if there's any other questions from our panel judges, but you are well over the time allotted. Any questions?
I'm sorry about that.
Further questions? No. We were indulging you. Anything else, Judge Reyes or Judge Jessen? All right, it then appears that the matters are submitted. That means a decision will be issued within the statutory timeframe. Compliments to both attorneys. The matters were well briefed as well as well argued. And with that said, this panel will adjourn to discuss any cases that need to be resolved by non-oral argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.